I wasn't working on generalized complex structures for a little while, a couple of years. Then I went back to it, and I decided to go back to basics. And so it's going to be really basic. So the first thing I want to talk about is something called a log symplectic structure. Now, log structures are really hot right now for people studying Calabi-Yau manifolds. This is a topic that is very hot right now for people studying Poisson geometry, real Poisson geometry, very classical differential geometry. So what is a log symplectic structure? It's amazing because it has such a such an incredibly short definition. M is a 2n manifold, smooth 2n manifold. Pi is a section, smooth section of wedge 2t, and it's Poisson. And it has one condition on it, an open condition, which is that if you take the highest power, this should be a section of wedge 2n of t, which is a real line bundle. And this is a section of a real line bundle. It's like a function. And the only condition is that it's transverse to the zero section. So if this is a determinant of Tm, this is intersecting the zero section transversally. That's all. So it's the simplest kind of Poisson structure, which is not symplectic. The simplest kind of, so if pi to the n happened to intersect the zero section nowhere, then pi inverse is a symplectic form. Okay, so these are a really nice class of Poisson manifolds. So let me tell you something very surprising about these things. So let's look at dimension 2. Dim m equals 2. This was studied by Radko, who's at UCLA. And what she proved about these things in dimension 2 is that, well, what do they look like? So you have a two-dimensional manifold. Pi is, I mean, you don't have to take pi to the n. N is equal to 1 in this case. So pi is a section of a real line bundle. So this is a section of a line bundle, which is just wedge 2 of the tangent bundle. So the zeros is a one-dimensional submanifold. It's a hypersurface, right? It has to be transverse, so it has to be cut out smoothly. So this means that the zero set will look like a collection of circles. Okay? And the symplectic, I don't know, I always think of symplectic forms as being blue. So it's blue, symplectic here, but then the symplectic form goes to infinity because its inverse, pi, is going to zero. Pi is going to zero here, so the symplectic form blows up, okay, and then it changes sign on this side. So on this side, it's green. And on this side, it's blue. And on this side, it's green. So the orientation defined by this thing flips depending on what side of the circle you're on. These circles don't necessarily have to have orientable normal bundle. It could be that it's a non-trivial normal bundle, in which case it doesn't separate. But anyway, that's what happens. So you have these circles. Any questions about this? So far, very simple type of geometric structure. Okay, not only that, so this is a collection of circles, of embedded S1s. Okay. Second thing that she proved, well, okay, this didn't require much proof. Second thing that she observed is that if you take pi along one of its zeros, so let's say that d is a component of the zero set. So let's say this thing, this circle is D. I'll call it D. So if that's D, if I restrict pi to D, then I can differentiate it. And this will be a section of the conormal to D tensor, the tangent, wedge 2 of Tm restricted to D. And I can trace this if I take this conormal and contract it on this bivector, I'm going to end up with a vector, and that vector will be tangent to D. So I get a vector field along D, which is nowhere vanishing, non-zero. Okay. So this means that there's actually a vector field naturally defined on here. Actually, I should have drawn it this way, right? And then it flips. So on each of these circles, there's a this goes this way, so it should be like this. Okay, on each of the circles there's a vector field, which means that we can integrate this, and we get numbers, positive real numbers. These are called periods. Okay. So we have a collection. So far, we have a collection of S1s. We have a period. Okay. And so far that was maybe not too difficult to determine. An interesting thing that she also observed is that if you try to, a symplectic manifold has a Liouville volume. You integrate the volume, you get a number. If you try to integrate this, this goes to plus infinity, but this is going to minus infinity, and the rate is exactly the same since it's a transverse zero. So they cancel out, and you get a well-defined volume. There's a well-defined volume, which is to integrate over the surface the inverse of pi. So this is well-defined in the sense of principal value. And this is a real number. It could be zero or negative. It doesn't determine an orientation. So that's the difference for the symplectic case. So what she proved is that this classifies. Up to isomorphism, this is the classification. It's classified by a bunch of real numbers, which are positive, another one that could be anything, and then the topological configuration of circles. So even though we're not dealing with a symplectic manifold, the structure theory of this type of thing is very nice, very well behaved. Okay. So in general, what do these things look like? So in general, let me just draw a picture of it. So we have the manifold, which is a 2n-dimensional manifold. And the top power of the Poisson tensor is vanishing transverse to zero. And it determines a hypersurface, a closed hypersurface, which I'll draw like this, D. This is, it's a 2n minus 1 manifold. And this is the zero set of pi to the n. Sorry, pi to the n has a zero set, which is this hypersurface, D 2n minus 1. Okay? When I restrict the Poisson tensor to this hypersurface, so this is also Poisson. This is a Poisson hypersurface. Okay, and so the Poisson tensor over here, this is a Poisson tensor on an odd dimensional space. The symplectic leaves will be even dimensional. And so this thing is foliated by symplectic leaves. And if we assume that D has one compact leaf, symplectic leaf, F. Okay. Let's say I'll draw it here like this. This is F, and this has dimension 2n minus 2. It's codimension 2 now inside here. The reason I'm saying that it's not too surprising that the dimension of the rank of the Poisson tensor on D is just basically as high as it could possibly be. It's 2n minus 2 on this odd dimensional manifold. The reason it's so high is because the thing is generic, because of that genericity assumption. So as soon as it drops rank, all it does is it drops rank the smallest amount that it could possibly drop, which is dropping rank by 2 from here. This is symplectic locus. This is rank, co-rank 2 locus. And as soon as we assume that there's one compact symplectic leaf, then the whole thing is foliated by symplectic leaves of that dimension. And the whole thing fibers over a circle. That's the picture. And this was proven by Gilliman, Miranda, Pires. I can't remember if it's, I think it's 2012 or 13. Oh, no, 2012. So in other words, the degeneracy locus is a, so not only does it fiber over this, but the degeneracy locus is a symplectic mapping torus. So in other words, you have this symplectic 2n minus 2 manifold. Okay, if you go around the circle, there's a symplectomorphism, which maps it back to itself, which I'll call phi, and that's what the picture is. So you have this f here, and as you go around, you get a identification of f with itself, which is symplectic. So this is a symplectomorphism. Okay, so that's part of the data, and the reason that I say that that there is this symplectomorphism, the reason that you have this flow along that circle is because the same vector field that we defined here, the same vector field from before, from early, defines transverse Poisson vector field to this. So there's actually a vector field which is doing this and which identifies these fibers. So it's a very beautiful type of geometry. You have a generically symplectic space of even dimension, and then there's a hypersurface, real codimension 1 inside, which itself is foliated by the highest dimension symplectic leaves they could possibly be. And if we assume there's one compact one, then there's this vector field that drags it around a circle to generate all the other symplectic leaves. And so you have a bunch of these hypersurfaces stuck there inside this thing. And that classifies. So this, and this vector field also gives a period, lambda inside R positive. So this is, let me just enumerate the data that you have. One, two, and the third piece of data is the characteristic class of the normal bundle of D, which is an element in H1 of F Z2 coefficients invariant under the symplectomorphism cross Z2. So a description of this. This is basically an interpretation of the Gilliman Miranda Pires paper, but the classification is given by all this data. So this classifies 1 plus 2 plus 3, 1 plus 2 plus 3 classifies. Okay, assuming that the topological type of D is fixed. So you just, it's the same type of statement as in the Radko case. Okay, so this is a kind of an interesting type of geometry. A lot of people have been studying it, seeing what they can do with it in terms of like how much of symplectic geometry can we extend to these types of spaces. Okay, and there's an interesting point of view on this. So different point of view on the same thing. Which is something like this. So, yeah.
Just a really quick question.
Yeah.
Do you
require
these?
No, they could have several components.
Okay.
Yeah. Each one would fiber over a circle.
All right.
Yeah. And actually, if you're worried about this assumption about the compact leaf, let's say that someone gives you one of these things so that foliation, the symplectic foliation, is irrational and it doesn't have a compact leaf. Then you can always perturb it so that it does. So there's unobstructed deformations, which I'm going to talk about So you can always arrange the thing. There's always one nearby, arbitrarily close by, that actually has a compact leaf. Or I'm assuming the whole thing is compact. I'm just assuming that D is compact. Assuming that D is compact, if it has one compact leaf, then the whole thing fibers over the circle. Yeah.
Well,
it's called Poisson isomorphism, or what they call ichthyomorphism. Isomorphism of fish. Anyway, you can think about it. Yeah, that's the equivalence relation. Okay, so there's a different way of thinking about this, which is to separate the geometric structure, the Poisson structure, from the hypersurface. Consider the hypersurface separately as a separate piece of geometric data. Okay, so given only MD, you know, D codimension 1, consider, well, this, for those who came to the colloquium, this will be familiar, TM minus D, minus log D. So these are vector fields on M, smooth vector fields on M, tangent to D. So if this is D, and if it's given by, let's say, x equals 0, and then there's other coordinates, let's say y and z, okay. Oh, sorry, no, God, sorry. X is the coordinate that cuts D out. D is of codimension 1. And then along D, there's other coordinates, y and z, say. So the vector fields which are tangent to D, well, certainly d by dy and d by dz are there. But d by dx is not there because it's not tangent to d. On the other hand, x times d by dx is included because this is technically tangent to d. And so that's an example of what it's generated by. You could say it's generated by x d by dx and dyi up to n minus 1. Okay, so this means that these sections, how many of them are there? Well, it's the same as the dimension. So this sheaf, or whatever you want to call it, is generated by a certain number of sections, which equals the dimension. And so this means that T minus log D is a vector bundle rank N over M. And it has a map to TM, and it's a Lie algebraoid, which just means that you have a bracket on sections. Okay, so this is a Lie algebraoid which is adapted to a codimension 1 closed hypersurface. It just consists of vector fields, but vector fields with this mild constraint of being tangent to D. The interesting thing always is that when we make this constraint of requiring it to be tangent to D, it doesn't cut down on the number of generators. That's the funny thing. It cuts down on which vector fields are included, but it does not cut down on the number of generators. And so the resulting thing is kind of, in many ways, just like the tangent bundle. It's just slightly different. It's just a modified vector bundle, but still, you know, with all of the same properties as the tangent bundle. That's somehow the attractiveness of these log structures in some way. Okay, so so one of the things you could do is you could ask the question, let's say I take this T minus log D, this bundle, and let's say I take the exterior algebra on its dual, and take the Durham derivative for this thing, and it has a Durham derivative because for all intents and purposes, it's exactly like the tangent bundle. So this is called the logarithmic Durham complex. Okay, and the cohomology of this was computed. So if we're in the holomorphic category, if we were talking about a complex manifold with a codimension 1 hypersurface, this cohomology was basically investigated by Groth and Deek and you know and others, the famous writer of the textbook being textbook in algebraic geometry, Hartshorne. Yeah, thank you. So the cohomology in this case, in the real case, was computed by Matteo and Melrose. They needed it quite in the early 80s because they were doing things about index theory on manifolds with boundary. And this boundary was treated as a codimension one hypersurface. So it was important for them to understand this cohomology. The interesting thing, I mean, for them, from their point of view, the reason why this theory is interesting is because this operator is no longer elliptic. As you can see, the vector fields are dropping rank along the hypersurface. So from the traditional point of view, this is not elliptic. Okay. However, what they found was that HK log D, the kth cohomology log D, is the same as the kth cohomology of M, direct sum, the K minus 1 cohomology of D. Okay. Which means that they got yeah, so if you think about that for a second, I mean what Melrose, the reason that they were so interested by this fact was because you're getting a finite dimensional cohomology theory from something not elliptic. Right? So this opened up a whole world for them of seeing how far they could push the elliptic assumption and still get Fredholm operators. Fredholm operators are the key thing that gives you finite dimensional kernel and co-kernel. But the fact that it's Fredholm is implied by the fact that it's elliptic, but it's not the other way around. So they realized that there was a class of operators that could still give you Fredholm operators, even though they're not elliptic. And this is the first, well, the simplest case where you find that. And that's going to come up later when I talk about it. Let me just see if... So I can explain a little bit of why this is the case. So something about the proof, which is not difficult, it's really the observation that, so if you have something which is a differential form log D, then what it looks like is it looks like alpha wedge dx over x plus beta, where both of these are smooth. Okay, so something which is, has logarithmic singularities, there would be, if you wrote the form out, one part of the form would have this log singularity, d log x here. This would be smooth, so this is like a k minus 1 form. And this would just be completely smooth, so this would be a k form and this would be a k minus 1 form. And the point is that if you approach D, this thing has a singularity as we approach x equals 0, but this thing is the residue and is well defined at D. So you get a map to omega k minus 1 of D. So this is k forms on M with logarithmic singularity. If I take the residue, then I get this. And you can get anything that way. And here, if I look at the kernel, then if you have something which is 0 here, what this means is that alpha at x equals to 0 is vanishing. And so that means that it has a kind of coefficient of x inside it. And that x will cancel with this x. Because this thing is vanishing at x equals 0, so that vanishing will cancel this 1 over x. And you'll get something smooth. And indeed, the kernel of this is just smooth k forms. And what you just need to explain is how this thing splits. So in cohomology, this splits, the long exact sequence splits. This involves just choosing it's not difficult. It's not difficult to use a bump function. Just use a bump function to smooth out something, and you can prove that this splits, and so you get the right cohomology. This is not the same answer that Grothendieck got for the logarithmic Durham complex in the holomorphic category, because the complement M, when you remove something of codimension one, or if you remove something of complex codimension one, the cohomology is different of the complement. So you get something topological that happens, which changes the answer. In the Grothendieck's answer, this is not here, and this is the cohomology of the complement of D. So it's very strange. From the algebraic geometry point of view, this answer is very unusual. Okay, so the reason that I'm telling you about this is for a very simple reason, which is that so now that we have this T minus log D and this map to Tm, to T, let me draw the following diagram. Actually, I have to change this. So let me draw the following diagram. So I have T star M and Tm. And imagine that I have one of these Poisson structures that I spoke about before. Then Tm, it receives a map A from this T minus log D. Okay, and the dual of this map is going to T star log D. This minus sign is just kind of convention. It's negative because the vector fields are vanishing. It's positive because they're going to infinity. Anyway, so you have these two maps. And this thing is such that pi to the n vanishes transversally to zero. Right? That was the definition of these log symplectic structures. This Poisson structure of this type, it vanishes transversely. So this thing, if we take, yeah, so the point is that if I take the determinant of this whole diagram, right, then here, this one will become a map from the determinant here to the determinant there. And that map is going to be the square of this thing. So the determinant of pi as a map from wedge n, wedge 2n, t star to wedge 2n, t, this is equal to double pi to the n. You could think about why that is, but anyway, it's double pi to the n. And the determinant of these things, so this anchor map, it drops rank to order one. So in a way, what's happening is that in the determinant, this determinant here is dropping rank to order 2, and both these maps are dropping order by 1, and it implies that actually this map lifts up here to an isomorphism. Okay. So another way of saying this, maybe one way to make this clear is that there's this kind of silly way of saying it, which is that if I take pi, let me just take the two-dimensional case. Pi is like x d by dx wedge d by dy. So this is the case that Radko studied. It's a Poisson structure which vanishes to order 1. If I take the inverse of this, I get dx over x wedge dy. So right away, you can see that it's non-degenerate from the log point of view. This is just d log x wedge dy. So it's a non-degenerate two-form because these are both generators of that bundle. So this is non-degenerate and gives an isomorphism in that way. Okay. So this is the point. So the point is that in this different point of view, pi may be viewed as a usual symplectic structure, omega, as a section of wedge 2a star i.e. it's non-degenerate and dA omega equals 0 for a modified version of the tangent bundle, which is this log tangent bundle. That's the point. Okay. And this means that you can really kind of change your way of thinking and say that really what I'm looking at is just a closed two-form, rather than a Poisson structure which has this kind of behavior. And just an example of what you get from this is that, you know, when you study symplectic geometry, you have so outputs of this. In symplectic geometry, you have Moser's theorem. So Moser's theorem basically says that if you have a family of symplectic forms and they're not varying in their cohomology class, then they're all equivalent. So in other words, the moduli space of symplectic structures is the second cohomology. So it's kind of like a deformation theory result. It tells you what all nearby symplectic structures look like, and it also tells you that they're unobstructed. So as a result, we get this Moser's theorem by exactly the same argument. And the thing tells you, for example, that these Poisson structures are unobstructed. Unobstructed deformation space given by the Matteo Melrose H2 log D, which is just H2 of M plus H1 of D. Okay. And you can see right away that if you were in the two-dimensional case, this thing is one-dimensional. And this, well, depending on how many circles D consists of, if let's say there's n circles, then there's going to be n dimensional space here, which means that the moduli space of these log symplectic structures is 1 plus n, which is exactly the regularized volume plus all of the modular periods. Right? So you kind of recover the moduli space. You see what the moduli space is right away. I mean, just instantaneously when I tell you that it's a symplectic form. Okay. So, what time is it? Half an hour. Great. Excellent. Okay. That's what I was hoping. Okay. And maybe the last thing that I should say, the other output besides Moser's theorem we also have a second output, which is, remember that in a symplectic manifold, the cohomology class of the symplectic form is an invariant. So we know that we have an H2 class such that its top power is non-zero, right? And so that tells you right away that certain spaces like S6, for example, could never have a symplectic structure. S4 can never have a symplectic structure. There's nothing in H2, right? So it's the most elementary invariant of a symplectic manifold. And so here, you get a similar result. So just recently, Marcut and Osorno Torres proved just recently that, just kind of inspired by this type of idea, they just proved that that on a log symplectic manifold, there always exists a class C in second cohomology of the manifold, such that C, not to the nth power, but to the n minus first power, is non-zero. Okay? And that has to do with this whole Matteo Melrose business. So you will have a second cohomology class, and the claim is that if you raise it to the penultimate power, then you get something non-zero. And this, for example, was used to prove right away just that S6 has no log symplectic structure. And okay, I mean, that's just an example. It's just surprising because at first, when these log symplectic structures were first defined, it seemed like, you know, it seemed like you have this symplectic form and it's allowed to change its volume to positive and negative and, you know, change over these hypersurfaces. So people had this kind of naive idea that they were very loose, that you could just move them around and that there was not really much to finding them on manifolds. But But clearly, that was a naive idea. I mean, they're so close to being symplectic, even from a cohomology point of view. So this is just for example. I don't think that's a was not a big conjecture or anything to that effect. Okay, so I wanted to give this example as a kind of motivation, and also as a kind of as a kind of good idea for the future in a way, because what this is an example of is taking a geometric structure, and rather than kind of just hitting it head on with everything you have, try to reinterpret it by breaking it down into different steps. So here what we noticed is that, it was defined as being transverse to the zero section, but as a consequence of that, we got this codimension one hypersurface. Well, what if we separate that out and just say, well, first let me consider codimension one hypersurfaces. They determine this algebraoid T minus log D. Great, so now there's a whole geometry to do with that, and you go to Melrose and Matteo, and they tell you what the cohomology is, and so you learn that first, and then you say, but then I could study symplectic structures on that thing. And then you get to the second level, and you're really studying these Poisson structures in the original manifold. So as an idea, I think it's kind of very attractive that you kind of look at what comes out of your geometry and try to see if you can posit that as a first step to understanding the geometry. And so it's basically this idea that I want to apply to generalized complex geometry. So any questions about this kind of whole thing?
If you're on an elliptic curve, you take a bunch of circles, and you have to sort of get positive and negative areas. And if you have, I don't know, maybe a
that's even absolutely
number.
If the parity is wrong, then it won't
exactly
work. Exactly. Yeah.
So do you understand the conditions on D that you need to have?
All we have is certain invariants. Like also in Marcoute Torres, they have a class on D itself, which has to satisfy this condition. So in fact. This class, there's actually a first cohomology class on D itself that has to be non-zero, that coming from the circle. I mean, the whole thing has to fiber over circle, which is already a pretty strong constraint. So I guess it could be, basically it could be any symplectic manifold fibering over a circle. That's what it is. In a sense, these geometries are interesting, but they're not that complicated. They're pretty simple. We have a complete classification of them. I'm just saying that there's another way of thinking about them, which is useful for deducing theorems about them. Anything else? Okay. Okay, so so now I'm going to just repeat my talk. It's up to this point. Except that I'll just make slight modifications, and it will please you, hopefully. So now let's look at another type of simple type of geometry, generalized complex geometry. Except that generalized complex structures can be pretty complicated in general, so we're going to simplify them by just saying the non-degenerate case. So the non-degenerate case. A generalized complex structure, is a complex structure on T plus T star. So complex structure here, which is involutive for the Courant bracket, which is a natural bracket on T plus T star. So these things, and the usual examples that are given are if I have a usual complex structure on the tangent bundle, and if I take its dual on the cotangent bundle, then that works. So this is the complex case. And then another example is that if I take a symplectic form and think of it as a map from T to T star, then that also works. This is the symplectic case. But the non-degenerate case is something that looks like the following. So it looks like, so let me describe it in dimension four. So dimension four is the most interesting, it's the first interesting dimension. So in dimension four, it looks like this. You have a four manifold, and it's symplectic generically. Okay, but then there's a locus, just like before, where it ceases to be symplectic because the symplectic form is going to infinity. That locus is now of codimension two. I'll call it D again, but this is now codimension two. And the local neighborhood, so if I choose a point here and I look at the neighborhood, then what this looks like, it's not necessary to really know this in detail, but the geometry is determined by a differential form of the type Z1 plus DZ1 wedge DZ2, okay, in the sense that at Z1 equals 0, at Z1 equals to 0, this differential form, which contains a degree 0 and a degree 2 part. So when the degree 0 part is 0, then what you have is DZ1 wedge DZ2, which is a Calabi-Yau structure in four dimensions, and it determines a complex structure. So we have DZ1 wedge DZ2, which is a complex structure. But at Z1 not equal to 0, then this thing is equal to, I can factor out a Z1, and I get Z1 times e to the DZ1 over Z1 wedge DZ2, which I can write as Z1 e to the b plus I omega, where I take the real and imaginary parts of this thing, and this this is symplectic. This is symplectic, and this is a B-field transform of a symplectic structure. So the local geometry, the way that it's changing from symplectic to something which is not symplectic, is governed by this type of local normal form. At the zero set, this codimension two, this is the codimension two thing that I call D. What's happening is that you get a complex structure, and then away from that codimension two locus, it can be expressed as e to the b plus I omega, and it determines a symplectic form. Okay, so you need to kind of, I'm not giving you the whole story here, but people who've seen mirror symmetry will be maybe a little more comfortable with this idea that it's determined by a pure spinner in differential forms. Okay, but basically the idea, so if you don't want to look at the details, this is a symplectic form which is going to infinity, and then at this thing, it's determining a complex structure. So this means that D inherits, has a complex structure. It's an elliptic curve. It's an elliptic curve because you actually have a this differential form which is the Calabi-Yau structure on it. So this inherits a complex structure, and also ND is a holomorphic line bundle. That comes from the fact that this thing, this Calabi-Yau structure, it kind of determines. It determines a complex structure on the whole tangent space, not just the tangent space to the curve, but on everything. So it inherits a complex structure on the normal bundle. And it's actually a holomorphic structure on the normal bundle. And then the rest, M minus D, is symplectic. Okay. So this is the dimension four case. So let me just describe the dimension six case, and then you'll get the point of how these things always look. So in dimension six, you have a six manifold, and then you also, again, you have a codimension two degeneration. So there's the geometry changes on a four manifold. So D is now a four manifold. So this is symplectic here. And the symplectic structure goes to infinity. And what it does is it determines on this D4 what's called a generalized Calabi-Yau structure. So it's analogous to this. You get here, you get a generalized Calabi-Yau structure, which is of a very special, a very simple type. It's a fibration of symplectic manifolds of codimension 2. So this whole thing is, again, fibered. So if we assume there exists a compact leaf, there is a Poisson structure underneath all this. I don't want to get into it, but anyway, the whole thing is fibered by symplectic codimension 2 fibers. Then the whole thing, this fibers over an elliptic curve. It's kind of surprising. So this is a symplectic fibration over an elliptic curve, which has a holomorphic structure. These are symplectic manifolds of codimension now. So D is of codimension 2. This is codimension 2 inside D, so they're codimension 4. So it's surfaces. So they are actually, as I drew them, they're surfaces. So basically, you have a six-dimensional manifold. You have a four-manifold stuck in there. That four-manifold fibers in surfaces over a complex curve, which is an elliptic curve. And so that's how the picture is generally. You always have a 2n manifold. You have a codimension 2 degeneration locus. That thing fibers in codimension 2 over an elliptic curve. It always fibers over an elliptic curve. It's a strange type of geometry. Let me give you a funny example of this. Funny example of such a six manifold. This one is non-compact, but it's still kind of interesting. So if I have, if X is a three manifold, and inside X you have a knot, okay, and if we choose an almost complex structure on the normal bundle of the knot, choose a complex structure on the normal bundle of the knot, and then what you do is you take the cotangent bundle of X over X. So this is now a six manifold, which is symplectic. So you have to imagine that we have this three-dimensional manifold. We're taking the cotangent bundle. That's symplectic. Inside the three-manifold, we have a knot. Transverse to the knot, there's a complex structure. Okay. Now, think of that complex structure like a Riemann surface. So if you had a Riemann surface and you have this trivial bundle over the Riemann surface, then you can always twist the bundle by doing this tensor by OD. You can twist whenever you have a Riemann surface and you have a divisor. You can twist it. So here, what you can do is you can twist the cotangent bundle along this knot because of the fact that you've chosen this complex structure. So you can twist this transverse to the knot, and you get a different bundle over X. And this this thing is generalized complex with type change. With type change localized to the knot. In other words, the four-dimensional manifold where the type change is happening is actually the restriction of the rank three bundle to the knot itself. This is four-dimensional, and it's the degeneration locus. So it's a kind of interesting thing that to any framed knot in a three-manifold, you can associate a generalized complex manifold where the type change is occurring exactly over that knot. Okay. How much time do I have remaining? Yeah, honestly. Okay, excellent. That's all I need. Honestly. Tell me a lie. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to say is, you know, how do we apply that philosophy from the first part of the talk to this type of geometry? Is it possible to see is it possible to see this as something simple related to a manifold equipped with a codimension 2 submanifold? So in the literature, you will not find really a construction like the one I'm about to show, but you find something in the holomorphic category, which is exactly what I'm about to show. So in the holomorphic category, people do this, do what I'm about to do all the time. So the trick applied to these non-degenerate generalized complex structures. How does the trick work in this case? So it's a little bit more subtle, but so let's suppose that M is a 2N manifold. And inside M, we have D, which is of codimension 2 now, real codimension 2. And then, so what's the problem with just looking at this? So, I mean, before I had something of codimension 1, and I said, take all the vector fields which are tangent to it. So what if I do it in this case? So if I look at vector fields tangent to this, let's say this is D, and let's say that X and Y are the normal coordinates, and then Z is tangential to D. Yes? Okay, so X and Y are the normal coordinates. So if I look at vector fields tangent to D, what do we get? Well, certainly D by DZ is in there. What else is in there? I mean, clearly X, d by dx is not in there. X del x is in there. Y del y. All of these are in there, right? So you have two functions which are vanishing. Two vector fields which are not vanishing, but you have all possible combinations here, here, and here, and here. So we have now not what you would expect. So here I would have expected three generators to get something of rank 3 like the tangent bundle. But instead, what I'm getting is 5 generators. And not only do you have too many generators, but you have relations among these. So it's not even freely generated. So here you see that, you know, y times this is the same thing as x times that. So these are not, it's not even freely generated. So this is an example of a sheaf which is not locally free. It's not locally free. It's free away from D. Away from D, it's just vector field. So it's free of rank 3. But here it's not even locally free, and it has rank 5, or you know, has 5 generators. So this is no good. At least for my purposes, it's no good. So what you need to do is you need to cut down on the number of these generators. So to cut down, the idea is choose something which is very topological, something very easy to choose. Choose an almost complex structure, normal to D. Let me call it I. So I'm going to make that choice. And then what you can do is you can, so as a result of that choice, we can consider, I'll just define this now, T minus log D is defined to be vector fields, which, you know, are, first of all, tangent to D. Okay, so first they have to be tangent to D. So whenever you have a vector field which is tangent to a submanifold, if you were to do the flow of that vector field, the flow would act on the neighborhood of that submanifold, and it would fix the submanifold. I mean, it would send the submanifold and just slide it around on itself, right? Any vector field tangent to D is just going to move D around, and it will act on the normal bundle of D. And that normal bundle has a structure. It has a complex structure. So I'm going to require that flow fixes the complex structure. So it has to be tangent to D, and it has to fix, it has to preserve the normal complex structure. And that's a well-defined condition. That's, if you think about that, you can show that it's this is something that makes sense. Once you know that it's tangent to D, it will act on the normal bundle, and then you just act that it, you ask that it preserves the complex structure. And this cuts it down to d by dz, x del x plus y del y, the Euler vector field, and then x del y minus y del x. Then it's generated by 3, and it's generated freely by 3. So then it's locally free, free of rank tm, or same as the rank dimension of m. So that's what the analog of a log structure, that's what a log structure looks like for something of codimension 2. It somehow involves choosing this codimension, this complex structure, normal to D. So we call this DI. Is called a complex divisor. So I've been looking at this with Cavalcanti a little bit, and we were able to prove the following thing. So having this complex divisor DI, a symplectic structure omega, which is a section of wedge 2 of A star, same as before. It's almost the same as before. So we have a 2 form such that D omega is equal to 0 for A T minus log D. Okay. Has a certain property. It has a residue, certain kind of residue. What is this residue? It's easy to describe. So the differential forms A star, it's generated by, let's say if I write polar coordinates for the transverse, let's say I write x plus iy is equal to r e to the I theta, then these logarithmic forms, they're generated by dr over r d theta, and then smooth things, so dz's, smooth ones. Okay, and if I give you a 2 form, then that 2 form will have one term which looks like omega 0 times dr over r wedge d theta, and then it'll have omega 1, which is dr over r plus omega 2 d theta plus omega 3, which is smooth. Okay, so this is a general decomposition in local coordinates for omega, and the result is that this residue is really just omega zero restricted to D. So omega zero restricted to D is well defined, and it's called the residue. Okay, and it turns out that symplectic. So log symplectic structures with zero residue correspond exactly to generalized complex structures with degeneration on D of non-degenerate type. So it's exactly equivalent. To prove this, you need to use B-field transforms to bring these into line to make them into this nice real format. So in other words, we were able to express what it means to be a generalized complex structure purely as a symplectic form. And then as an immediate consequence of this, we get right away unobstructedness, which is something that we were not certain about. So this is similar to the Calabi-Yau case, where you do have an obstruction group, but the thing is unobstructed anyway because of the Tian-Todorov lemma. So this gives you Tian Todorov lemma. In fact, you know, sometimes they call it Bogomolov-Tian Todorov because Bogomolov proved it first for symplectic structures. Tian Todorov proved it for Kolabiyov structures. This proof is exactly Bogomolov's proof. It's the same as that original proof of this unobstructedness theorem. And also, we believe that we can prove using this that S6 has no non-degenerate generalized complex structures, although at the moment we can only prove that it doesn't have one with a single degeneration locus. It could be that there's many degeneration loci, but I highly doubt it. But to be honest, we can only prove that that this is true, assuming there's only one locus, which is something that we were wondering for a long time. Can we find any real obstructions to the existence of GC structures on almost complex manifolds? It's been, we thought that the Seiberg-Witten invariant would give us an obstruction, but it did not, because we have these examples now which have zero Seiberg-Witten invariant. That's all. Thank you.
Before that, let me remind you that there is the banquet is at 6 today. The bistro. Let's remind you.
Thanks.